Shalom, shalom. I hope you've all been enjoying this as much as I've enjoyed doing this. We serve such an incredible king. He buries these treasures and then allows us to dig them up and truly begin to understand the depths of his mercy for us, his people. I hope you all can bear with my learning curve here. It's very awkward talking to a computer screen and a little tiny webcam that I'm recording this on. So it's gonna, hopefully in the future it won't be as awkward. You might have noticed in a couple of the videos my eyes have been shifting around because I'm trying to look at stuff on the screen. But it's a learning experience, and I hope you have all been enjoying this. So let's get started with part three of the teaching, Shadows of the Kingdom, Shavuot, in the Book of Ruth. All right. This is going to be kind of an overview of the Book of Ruth here. Ruth was a descendant of Lot. Now, the difference in time between when Ruth was born and when Lot lived was about 700 years. Now, interesting, it's a very similar amount of time to the time between when the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Ephraim, was exiled until Acts chapter 2, where Yeshua, his Talmudim, began the ingathering of the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Ruth, as we know, represents the line of Moab, who are returning to covenant. And something interesting, if you go look in 1 Kings chapter 14, Solomon actually married Naamah, who's a descendant of Ammon, and they produced Rehoboam, another person in the line of Messiah. So within the line of Lot, we see both of his sons, Moab and the line of Ammon, Ben-Ami, what was his name? I think it was Ben-Ami was the son's name. Ben-Ami. Are restored back into the line of Messiah. Even it's not even that they're back in the kingdom. They're in the line of the Messiah. It's incredible that even people that were lost, seemingly lost from the covenant, were brought back. And going back to this whole thing with Acts 2, Yeshua said, I came not but for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. His entire mission on this earth was redemption and the redeeming of the lost northern tribes, because he could not come and restore the kingdom to Israel until he had gathered back the entire house. He puts his house in order, and then he sets his house on Mount Sion to be a light to the nations. Word shuv, return, actually appears 14 different times in the Book of Ruth. This is very interesting because, Ruth is talking about the line of David, and the gematria for David is 14. And we can see that in Matthew 1 when it's talking about the generations of Yeshua, and it lists them out in 14. 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 generations from David to the exile, and then 14 generations from the exile to Messiah. So they're all kind of tied together there. Ruth versus Naomi. We'd already talked about how Ruth and Naomi were covenant sisters. And I hope that I made it pretty clear in part two of this teaching that Ruth represents the northern kingdom, the lost house of Israel, Ephraim, the house of Yosef. And Naomi represents the house of Judah. Naomi never was actually kicked out of the covenant. She throughout the whole story of Ruth, she was in covenant with Yahweh, but Ruth had been in covenant when married to Mahlon, lost that connection to the covenant, and then was later redeemed, much like Ephraim was kicked out of covenant in when you read the book of Hosea after the exile into Assyria, and now Messiah comes and restores Ephraim back to the covenant. So going back to the book of Ruth, Boaz has this personal redemption in his first encounter. He brings Ruth back in. Now I know he didn't technically redeem her, but we're supposed to see that there was a redemption that took place there, a personal encounter. It was just him and Ruth together. Much like Messiah, when he first came, he only came for Ephraim. And when he returns the second time, he's going to redeem the whole house of Israel. He's going to complete that redemption and bring us back into the land. Much like in Ruth at the end in chapter 4, both Ruth and Naomi are redeemed. Naomi is redeemed because Obed is born to her, it states. Obed is placed in Ruth's arm, or in Naomi's arms, and Naomi nurses Obed. So they are both redeemed at that point in time, as well as the land being redeemed. Ruth is also a picture of the bride. We want to be a bride, spotless and prepared for Messiah. And what do we see in Ruth chapter 3 when she is going to go and meet Boaz for that personal redemption? She prepares herself with bathing, anointing, and puts on clean clothes. Another characteristic of her, she never complains. She refuses to live negatively. She's very humble. She listens to instructions, and most importantly, and hardest for us to digest sometimes, she is a great follower. You know, in our culture, everyone looks up to the leader. They want, you know, the innovation and all that stuff. But in the ancient Near Eastern culture, it was much better to be a follower than a leader. It was considered more ennobling and was usually more productive than seeking out your own path. That's why when you look at the Jewish writings, they always talk about, you know, this so-and-so says in the name of his teacher, right? They're saying, I'm a follower of this great man. It kind of shows you that idea that it's better to be a follower, to learn under someone, than to set out on your own, just kind of create your own way of doing things. So this whole story, you know, like I said, Ruth represents Ephraim, Naomi represents Judah, Yeshua is represented by Boaz, and then that other redeemer, Polonial Moni, represents false prophets, false messiahs, and in the end, the Antichrist. All right. So, we're going to start to tie this all together. I'm going to kind of run through this quickly. This would be a whole teaching in itself. And if you've never heard this concept, please get on the blog, ask questions, or you know what is a great resource is if you go to Jim Staley's website, passionfortruth.com, you can watch for free his video Identity Crisis. You'll completely understand who we are. We are Israel. Two house, people get in this argument, two house, one house. You know, let's just stop arguing. The scriptures clearly speak of two houses. Does that mean that I'm a physical descendant of some lost kingdom? No, I don't know who I descended from. Does it matter? No, it doesn't. But prophetically speaking, there's a house of Judah and there's a house of Israel. And we've got to understand that concept because the house of Israel was lost. They were scattered among the nations 700 years before Messiah. So let's go over a couple verses here. Hosea 1, I'm not going to read this whole thing, but if you read the whole chapter of Hosea, Hosea is a prophet who is told, who is prophetically marries this harlot and produces children to prophesy against the house of Israel. So his first son is named Yisrael, because Yahweh is going to avenge the bloodshed that the house of Israel has done. The next son is named Lo-Rahuma, which means no compassion, for Yahweh will not have compassion on the house of Israel. And then the last son is named Lo-Ami, which means not my people, because Yahweh said, you are not my people, and I am not your Elohim. He divorced Israel. He sent them out, scattered them among the nations, and they were lost. You know, and there's a lot of speculation. In fact, if you read some of the Jewish commentary, they knew at the time that the Israel would return as Gentiles. So a lot of times when you're looking in the New Testament writings, in the first century writings, you'll see that they use the term Gentiles, and yet these seem to be Gentiles who are returning. That's because the term Gentiles was also used as a derogatory term for those lost 10 tribes. And if you don't believe me, it's you know, you can turn to, let's see, where do I want to go here? 1 Peter 1 verse 1, Kepha, the emissary of Yeshua to the chosen, the strangers of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. James, Yaakov, a servant of Elohim and the master Yeshua Messiah, to the 12 tribes who are in dispersion, greetings. James knew who he was talking about. James was the head of the newly formed assembly of Yeshua after Yeshua's death. He was writing to the 12 tribes of the dispersion. He understood that there was an ingathering going on. All right, so let's look at Israel, because this is one of these great mysteries in Scripture. Jeremiah 3, verse 8. All right. This is Yahweh speaking. And I saw for all the causes which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, and I put her away and gave her a certificate of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Yehuda did not fear, but went and committed whoring too. So Israel is divorced, but Judah was never divorced. Even though Judah did some of the, and actually even goes on and says, you know, Judah did even worse things, yet Judah was not put away. And why is that? Because out of Judah had to come the kingly line of Messiah. So then we'll go up to verse 1 of that same chapter. Elohim said, if a man puts away his wife, and she goes out from him and becomes another's man, does he return to her again? Would not the land be made greatly unclean? Yet you have committed whoring with many lovers, and you would return to me, declares Yahweh. Going down to verse 12. Go and proclaim these words to the north and say, return, O backsliding Israel, declares Yahweh. I shall not look on you in displeasure, for I am kind, declares Yahweh, and I will not hold a grudge forever. So, you know, we can see here, from just reading Jeremiah chapter 3, Yahweh had divorced Israel, his bride, and then he says, you know, according to the Torah, there's a commandment in there. If you divorce your wife, and she marries another man, you can't come back and marry her. That defiles the land. That is against the Torah. And yet Yahweh says, I divorced you because you're sleeping with other men, now return to me. So how can that be? That's a violation of the Torah. Then this has been this was a huge mystery. And Shaul in Romans 7 reveals this mystery. He says, starting with Romans 7, verse 1, "Or do you not know, brothers, for I speak to those who know the Torah, that the Torah rules over a man as long as he lives. For the married woman has been bound by Torah to the living husband. But if the husband dies, she is released from the Torah concerning her husband. So then, while her husband lives, she shall be called an adulteress if she becomes another man's. But if her husband dies, she is free from that part of the Torah, so that she is not an adulteress, having become another man's. So, my brothers, you also were put to death to that part of the Torah through the body of Messiah, for you have become another's, the one who is raised from the dead, so that we should bear fruit to Elohim." So what Shaul is saying is that according to the Torah, Israel could not remarry Yeshua. He could not remarry Yahweh. However, when Yeshua came down and died, now Israel is no longer bound to that marriage covenant because he's dead now. Now he raised up and he's a new man. He's the first fruits of the dead. So now Israel is allowed to marry the new man. So this, it's essentially a legal loophole that Yahweh in the Torah that Yahweh used to legally remarry his bride. So this is this concept here that Israel, the house of Israel, was not allowed back in the kingdom, is all about Shavuot, and it reveals the answer to that question. Why was leavened bread offered on Shavuot? Let's first talk about bread. Bread is made with leaven. When we talk about the Passover, the commandments in the Passover are to, it doesn't say don't add leaven, it says remove it, meaning that leaven is part of bread, is a part of the bread that has to be removed. So it's very important to understand leaven is part of bread, but it's removed for Passover. And then after Passover is over, they can begin to add it back in there. And it's not actually, they don't actually go out and buy yeast. It's actually a sourdough starter type thing. So they would basically they'd have a little chunk of dough sitting out. They'd let it ferment. And you take out half, throw it away, and add some more to it. And it takes 30 to 40 days to get a good sourdough starter. About the same amount of time going from first fruits from the end of unleavened bread to Passover is about the time it would take for you to get a good sourdough starter going anyways. So we talked earlier about all these commandments about not having leaven as an offering. Leaven seemingly represents sin and pride, and it does not belong into an offering to Yahweh. And yet on Shavuot, we have this leaven added into the bread. Now flip that over, look into Israel. Ephraim seemingly was not allowed back in the covenant due to the Torah. And this was especially a big concept in the first century. The house of Shammai did not allow Gentiles into, Jews weren't allowed to eat with them. They weren't allowed to socialize with them. They weren't allowed to buy from them. They did not think that those people belonged in the covenant. So we put this all together. What did Shavuot and the leavened bread represent? It meant adding something in to the body, because bread represents the body of Messiah. It's adding something in that seemingly does not belong there. Ephraim seemingly did not belong in the kingdom, and yet they're added in. And they're, and now they're waved as an offering before Yahweh. And once they're added in, then the body, that the bread is able to, when baked, it expands out. It swells up its borders. And that should remind you of Isaiah 54, verses 1 through 3. Sing, O barren one, you who do not bear, break forth into singing and cry aloud, you who have not been in labor, for the children of the deserted one who are more than the children of the married one. Enlarge the place of your tent. Let them stretch out the curtains of your dwellings and spare not. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes. For ye shall break forth from the right and the left, and your seed inherit the nations and make the deserted cities inhabited. So right there, Isaiah, verse 1, the children of the deserted one are more than the children of the married one. The children of Ephraim are more than the children of Judah. And when Ephraim comes back in, the kingdom must swell up like a loaf of leavened bread. So that leavened bread represents the fullness of the kingdom. Ephraim finally added back into the kingdom. And now the kingdom has to expand its borders. Shavuot is all about the restoration of the whole kingdom of Israel. All right. Talk about some other things here. The harvest. Shavuot was the wheat harvest. Many of Yeshua's parables referred to a wheat, wheat, planting of wheat, and the tares growing up, the weeds growing up, separating the chaff from the wheat. And wheat is always refers to the righteous people. They're always known as the wheat, and either the tares or the chaff, those are the unrighteous ones. So if the festival of Shavuot prophetically marks the beginning of the wheat harvest, the ingathering of the wheat, that means it also must begin the ingathering of the tares and the chaff that will be taken out and burned. So as, if we do see a future fulfillment of the Feast of Shavuot, where the Bride of Messiah begins to get ingathered, you better believe that we're probably going to see the enemies start to gather together and form alliances against us. It's going to be separating the sheep from the goats. There's going to be a line drawn in the sand, and those people in the middle are going to have to make a choice. And let's just hope that we've shared enough with them that they make the right choice. I mentioned earlier that Shavuot is essentially kind of it's all built in together with Passover and the festival of first fruits. There's a 50 count of the Omer. So let's look at do a little bit of math here. What's the number of trial and testing? 40. Israel was in the wilderness for 40 years. So if we take 40 and multiply it by 50 days of counting the Omer, we get 2,000 years. i.e. the Yemot HaMashiach. So I believe that from the time that Shavuot and Acts 2 happened until the return of Messiah, we're in that counting of the Omer, the preparation for the ingathering of the wheat harvest. And there's another concept that goes with that, the concept of the early rain and the latter rain. Let's go to, let's start off in James chapter 1, verse 18. Let's go up to 16 for context. Do not go astray, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no change nor shadow of turning. Having purposed it, he brought us forth by the word of truth, for us to be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So we are supposed to be the first fruits. The bride is the first fruits. And just like there was a initial barley first fruits raising of the dead when Yeshua raised up, at Yeshua's at the Shavuot fulfillment, there's going to be another, you know, at the latter fulfillment, not necessarily on Shavuot, but, you know, at Messiah's return, there'll be another first fruits gathering of the bride. All right, going to James chapter 5, verse 7. So, brothers, be patient until the coming of the Master. See, the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waits patiently for it until it receives the early rains and the latter rains. So, this is my opinion, and I hope that I've backed it up enough, but I believe that the early rains was the outpouring of the Holy Spirit in Acts chapter 2, and that we, hopefully in our day, and I believe it will be in our day, we will receive the latter rains, when we'll go back and see exactly what was being prophesied in Acts chapter 2, when prophesied about the prophet Joel. And it shall be in the last days, says Elohim, that I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men dream. And also in my male servants and female servants, I shall pour out my spirit in those days, and they shall prophesy. So I believe, you know, and then it goes on and talks about seeing blood and fire and vapor of smoke, and the sun turned to darkness, and the moon turned to blood. Obviously, not all that stuff happened in the first century. So that must be a prophecy speaking about the latter rain and the pouring out of the Spirit on us at some near point in the future. And ultimately, this is all going to lead to a restoration of an earthly theocracy, the kingdom of Elohim. You know, the first theocracy was in Eden. Adam was in covenant with Yahweh. He was the suzerain over the earth, and he was to subdue it and lay it at the feet of Yahweh. The second Adam actually fulfills that. In 1 Corinthians 15, well, you know, I can't find the actual verse right now. I'll try to add it in when I edit the video. You know, but it talks about Messiah, who he has to subdue the entire earth and conquer everything, including conquering death. And once that's all conquered, he hands over the kingdom to his father, which is, you know, what Adam was supposed to do. Shavuot is part of that whole plan about restoring this earthly theocracy so that Yeshua will be the King of Kings, the suzerain, and he will work through us and with us on subduing the entire earth to worship Yahweh, Sevaot, and bring about the Olam Haba, the world that is to come. All right, last little bit of information to talk about here is kind of tying all together, like I was just talking about. I believe that Shavuot is all about restoration. Let's look at it. What happened at Mount Sinai? The Torah was restored. There was, you know, the Torah was given in the idea that there was a covenant that was given, but within that covenant were stipulations that were eternal. Yahweh's commandments are eternal. they weren't just first given there. So it was a restoration of the Torah, so to speak, at Mount Sinai. Acts chapter 2, 3,000 were restored to the kingdom. Those ones that representing the loss from the golden calf. Shavuot is determined by counting 50 days. 50 represents the Yovel year in which the land is restored and freedom is restored to the servants. Megillat Ruth, the book of Ruth, is all about the restoration through redemption. Ruth, a Moabite, a descendant of Lot, is restored back to Israel in the book of Ruth. And then, you know, I believe that Yeshua's disciples understood that Shavuot was about restoration, because what happened when they were, after Yeshua's resurrection, they're on the days leading up to Shavuot, Yeshua's disciples turned to him and asked him, "Are you, Master, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" And Yeshua didn't go, "Oh, you're way off. That's supposed to happen on the fall feasts." No, instead, he answered them, "It is not for you to know the times and the seasons which the Father has in store." It's a very odd answer, since earlier on in the Gospels, Yeshua had rebuked the Pharisees for not being able to discern the times and the seasons. So obviously we're supposed to know them. But what Yeshua is saying is that, you know, it's not for you to know the times and the seasons because it's not in your day. It is happening in the period known as Yemot HaMashiach. But, you know, unbeknownst to them, that period was going to be a 2,000-year period ending in our days when we finally get to see the return of our King, Yeshua the Messiah. I hope that you've all have enjoyed this teaching. And I want to thank Rico for giving me this great opportunity. Shalom to you.